for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from today, Seattle to Pittsburgh, from coast to coast. Welcome to KPTK, AM 1090. Thanks for running us live today. Been on the weekends there for some time. It is great to be on the air with you. And all of our other affiliates across the country on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, on WhiteRoseSociety.org, Apple iTunes, podcasting the program, CRN Digital, carrying us into digital cable systems in 29 states. Welcome back to our program. George W. Bush, clueless. This is perhaps the most frightening thing, if frightening is the right word. I mean, one of the most absolutely bizarre things that I've come across with regard to George W. Bush, and it is beginning to, and this is from Newsweek, it is beginning to validate a lot of the claims that have been made by folks such as Capitol Hill Blue, you know, the website Capitol Hill Blue, I believe it's .com, that have been saying now for a year and a half, 2 years, that George W. Bush goes off on rages, that he screams obscenities, that if people bring him bad news, he shouts them out of his office, that he's bitingly sarcastic. The biographies, for example, the Hatfield biography, Favorite Son, the guy who tracked down the fact that George W. Bush had been arrested for cocaine possession and use back when he was in his late teens, early 20s. And in Texas, and that's why he served those. That's, you know, in his biography, he talks about the 90 days. Was it? It was either 30 days or 90 days. But it was exactly, you know, it was exactly 30 days or exactly 90 days. I forget which. Where he worked in a homeless shelter and a soup kitchen kind of thing in downtown. As I recall, it was Houston, might have been Dallas. In any case, where he worked there, and he says in his biography, in his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, which, of course, he didn't write, but his ghostwriter wrote for him, says that he just did it because he felt, you know, the need to do some community service stuff. But Hatfield actually tracked down this that he'd been busted, and this was the plea bargain. And when he became governor, they issued him a new driver's license, and all of his old records, all his previous existence in Texas, vanished, ceased to exist. The slate got wiped clean. They said it was for security purposes. So, anyhow, they all the way from that point, and then Hatfield documenting that, and then documenting, suggesting anyway, saying that one of the reasons why George got sober was that Laura had essentially told him that she wasn't going to put up with him beating her up anymore when he was drunk. His drunken rages were just too much, and she was threatening to leave. And so there's all these stories. There have been all these stories about these sober rages, the violent temper of George W. Bush, the obscene outbursts. And we've seen a few of them. I mean, he flipped the press the bird, you know, the finger, a week or two ago. During the first campaign, his calling a New York Times reporter an expletive, those kinds of things. But now it gets really scary. And this is the danger, I think, to Americans. This is the danger to the United States of America, of having somebody in the White House, having somebody in power who essentially is like, you know, a Louis XVI, is a boy king, will not allow people to share scary or bad information with him, doesn't want to hear anything other than, you know, upbeat stuff, only wants to hear what he wants to hear, period. And it's really, in many ways, just a really, truly scary thing. I mean, it's just George W. Bush now from Newsweek. Newsweek talking about this. Just, you know, right up front. Like it's, you know, just laying it out. And it's going to be very interesting to see how many Americans get it. Get, you know, that the story here is not just Bush blew it on Hurricane Katrina. The story is the story behind the story, which is that his advisors were afraid to tell him about it. Why is it that George W. Bush didn't know until Thursday or Friday how bad things were because they were scared to death to tell him. Well, didn't he watch the news? No, he doesn't watch the news. Didn't he read the newspapers? No, he's quite proud of the fact that he doesn't read newspapers. The Newsweek story by Evan Thomas in the September 19th, 2005 issue. It starts out, it's a standing joke among the president's top aides. Who gets to deliver the bad news? That's a joke? I mean, that people working in the White House are terrified to deliver bad news to the president is a joke? Anyhow, back to Newsweek. Warm and hearty in public. Bush can be cold and snappish in private. And aides sometimes cringe before the displeasure of the President of the United States, or as he's known in West Wing jargon, POTUS. The bad news on this early morning, Tuesday, August 30th, some 24 hours after Hurricane Katrina had ripped through New Orleans, was that the President would have to cut short his five-week vacation by a couple of days and return to Washington. You get this? The bad news wasn't even, hey, people are dying in Louisiana. That wasn't the bad news that they were so terrified to deliver to him, although that was part of it. The bad news they were terrified to deliver to him was, sir, you're going to have to cut your vacation 3 days short. Back to Newsweek. The president's chief of staff, Andrew Card, his deputy chief of staff, Joe Hagan, his counselor, Dan Bartlett, and his spokesman, Scott McClellan, held a conference call to discuss the question of the president's early return and the delicate task of telling him. Delicate? Can you imagine having a president of the United States who doesn't want to hear the truth from his own people? Well, you don't have to imagine it. All you have to do is look. We have it. Hagan, it was decided, reports Newsweek, as senior aide on the ground, would do the deed. Bush aides, I mean, this is incredible. Bush aides were so afraid to tell him this that they practically drew straws. So finally, Tuesday, after the hurricane, but even Thursday after the storm, he still didn't get it. Quoting Newsweek, President Bush knew the storm and its consequences had been bad, but he didn't realize how bad. The reality, say several aides, who did not wish to be quoted because it might displease the president. What? You've got people working in the White House who are afraid not of committing a crime. I mean, you know, outing a CIA agent, bringing down an entire CIA operation, destroying a woman's career because her husband had the temerity to stand up and say, but the president is lying to us all. And bringing down an entire, you know, Brewster Jennings, this entire CIA operation, an international front corporation that was out there saying, hey, terrorists, you want to buy some weapons? We'll sell them to you cheap under the table. With agents all around the world. Bringing the entire thing down. One of our major ways of finding out who the terrorists are. Nothing wrong with that. In fact, Bush, you do that, Bush will defend you.
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Well, either he was lying, or the fellow that he affectionately refers to as Turd Blossom, Mr. Karl Rove, that being Rove's official nickname from George W. Bush, was lying to his president. You know, was Bush lying to we the people, or was Rove lying to Bush? And if it was, and it has to be one or the other. And why are either of these guys still in their jobs? But anyhow, back to the Newsweek story. President Bush knew the storm had been bad, didn't realize how bad. The reality, say several aides who did not wish to be quoted because it might displease the president, did not really sink in until Thursday night. Some White House staffers were watching the evening news and thought the president needed to see the horrific reports coming out of New Orleans. Counselor Bartlett made up a DVD of the newscasts so Bush could see them in their entirety as he flew down to the Gulf Coast the next morning in Air Force One. You get it? He doesn't watch the news. We're talking about Thursday, the fifth day after the storm hit. As Newsweek says, when Hurricane Katrina struck, it appears there was no one to tell President Bush the plain truth, that the state and local governments had been overwhelmed, that the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, was not up to the job, and that the military, the only institution with the resources to cope, couldn't act without a declaration from the president overriding all other authority. Now, where it gets very interesting is a spam email that's going out that appears to have originated deep within the bowels of the RNC or Karl Rove's operation. A spam email has gone out and is spreading across this country, talking about how before the hurricane hit, Bush was on the phone to Blanco and Nagin, begging them to take his help. It's an absolute total lie. Yet I've had at least a half a dozen Republicans and conservatives forward it to me just in the last 24 hours. It is really out there. The machine is at work.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Third time I've said that. I'll probably say it three more times. See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
You gave them the old razzle dazzle. You razzle dazzled them.
George, you did so well.
You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe. Compassion.
Indeed.
Gave them the old hocus pocus. Yeah, misdirected them. With 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. You played them both right to perfection. Despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them. Let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Welcome back, my friends. That was Bill Jacobs, by the way. BillJacobs.us is his website if you want to hear more of his music. Welcome back to the program. You know, the bigger picture here. Oh, and just so you know, if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click the chat room button up at the top of the page. Or if you'd like to call into the program, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. The bigger picture here is that for the better part of 200 years in the United States, starting with a group of men who literally, actually men and women as well, who literally put their lives on the line, and many of them lost their lives in the late part of the 1700s for the creation of this country, from the foundation, from the starting of this country, up until the time Ronald Reagan came into office. Service at the federal level, public service, being the president of the United States, leading this great nation, was always viewed as an honor and an obligation. Government was viewed as a noble thing, and government service was viewed as a noble thing. People understood that government is we the people, that we the people get together and we say, okay, there's part of our world, of our commons, what used to be called the commons, well, it's still called the commons. It's why, you know, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Virginia, the commons. There are parts of the commons that we are going to take responsibility for because it's really too big for any one family or any one neighborhood to take responsibility for. So we're going to build a fire department. We're going to build the police department for this city. We are going to build the bridges. We're going to build the highway infrastructure. We're going to make sure that the food supply for the whole country is safe. We are going to make sure that the drug supplies actually are safe and efficacious. We are going to make sure that our air is clean, that our water is pure, that our sewage is appropriately treated. There is a role for government. We are going to provide for the defense of the nation by mounting a military. And we are not going to hire private corporations who are working for private gain to, as Halliburton is doing now, bringing in contractors at $135,000 to $150,000 a year to put, you know, slop peas and mashed potatoes onto the plates of the GIs. No. Historically, before Reagan began with this whole thing about government is bad, government services, Reagan actually came right out and said, there are no good minds in government. If there were, they would have been hired away by private industry. He thought it was a joke. And when he said it, it got great laugh line whenever he said this before Republican groups. And it reflected this mindset that the only reason you have government is to steal what you can from the people. And the Republicans and a startlingly and disappointingly substantial chunk of the Democrats, particularly the DLC Democrats, have, ever since Reagan, been campaigning against government, been slandering government, and been trying to change our mind, trying to change our worldview from thinking that government is us, that it's we the people, that the government is the way that we take care of us, that we make sure that our needs are met. From that to, government and bureaucrats. Bureaucrats. You ever called your phone company? You want to meet some bureaucrats? You ever called an insurance company and tried to get somebody who can give you a straight answer about anything? You want to talk about bureaucrats? You know, I used to run an ad agency and do consulting work and training for mostly Fortune 500 companies. And I'll tell you, you want bureaucracy. You step into a multi-million dollar corporation, you got a bureaucracy that is mind-boggling. But these guys, they completely reinvented the whole thing. They said, no, government bureaucrats, they're the evil ones. Except that they're accountable to us, ultimately. We can hire new public officials through our vote. So what you're seeing now here with George W. Bush behaving like the boy king, behaving like Louis the 16th or something, George W. Bush saying he doesn't want to hear bad news, he's going to shout and scream obscenities at people who give him bad news, so much so that his four top aides are so terrified that they essentially get together and draw straws for who gets to tell him 2 days after the hurricane disaster that there's people drowning. Why doesn't he know? Because he won't watch the news on television. They might say something bad about him. He won't read the newspapers. They might say something bad about him. This is what we get. This is the logical result of the so-called Reagan Revolution. And it ain't a good thing. This is just terribly, terribly destructive to democracy in the United States. Let us hope. Let us all work together, my friends, to roll back this so-called conservative revolution. Because I'm telling you, Barry Goldwater's rolling over in his grave. And come back to embrace the principles of democracy in America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
At least George doesn't want to know. It's bad news. Please don't tell me. As the official, actually, it's not even please don't tell me. It's if you tell George W. Bush bad news, he's going to shout obscenities at you and chase you out of the room. Apparently, I mean, this is the story in Newsweek, absolutely amazing. And as we go through it, it just gets worse and worse and worse. So, Dan Bartlett, you know, his lawyer on Thursday. Now we're talking Thursday after the Saturday, Sunday, Monday storm, right? Thursday. His aides are watching, White House staffers are watching the evening news, quoting from Newsweek, and thought the president needed to see the horrific reports coming out of New Orleans. Counselor Bartlett made up a DVD of the newscast so Bush could see them in their entirety as he flew down the Gulf Coast the next morning on Air Force One. And then, you know, here again, quoting, now this is Thursday, so really he didn't find out until Thursday night or Friday morning. Was the first time he figured it out because no one wanted to tell him the truth. Here, from Newsweek, when Hurricane Katrina struck, it appears there was no one to tell President Bush the plain truth. That the state and local governments had been overwhelmed, that FEMA was not up to the job, and that the military, the only institution with the resources to cope, couldn't act without a declaration from the president overriding all other authority. Hey, wait a minute. There was no one to tell the president? When you had CNN, even Fox News, you had Shepard Smith down there going, Sean Hannity, I'll tell you what perspective is. There's people dying down here. In fact, to quote Newsweek, a Newsweek reconstruction of the government's response to the storm shows how Bush's leadership style, I would have I would have inserted the word so-called before the word leadership style. But in any case, how Bush's leadership style and the bureaucratic culture combined to produce a disaster within a disaster. A disaster within a disaster. 8 p.m. on Monday. Governor Kathleen Babineau Blanco, a motherly but steely figure, quoting Newsweek now, a motherly but steely figure known by the nickname Queen Bee, knew that she needed help, but she wasn't quite sure what. At about 8 p.m., we're talking Monday night, she calls George Bush, gets him on the phone. Mr. President, she said, we need your help. We need everything you've got. How does George W. Bush respond to this? I mean, there's lots of things he could have done. He could have ordered a full-scale federal takeover. But even short of that, he could have ordered out the military to take over the pitiful... Well, here, let me just read this. This is from Newsweek. Here are a number of steps Bush could have taken short of a full-scale military takeover, like ordering the military to take over the pitiful and by now largely broken emergency communication system throughout the region. But the president... Now, keep in mind, the governor has just called him and begged him for help. Monday night on the telephone, 8 p.m., quoting from Newsweek, but the president, who is in San Diego preparing to give a speech the next day on the war in Iraq, went to bed. That was Monday night. Tuesday, all day Tuesday, nothing happens. Wednesday, the president is still on vacation. His counselors are starting to get nervous. They're drawing straws for who's going to tell him that he has to cut his vacation short. Early Wednesday morning, Governor Blanco of Louisiana tries to call George Bush. She's desperate now. She's got people dying. To quote Newsweek, she was transferred around the White House for a while until she ended up on the phone with Fran Townsend, the president's Homeland Security advisor, who tried to reassure her but did not have many specifics. They go on to say, for most of those first few days, Bush was hearing what a good job the feds were doing. Bush likes metrics, numbers to measure performance, so the bureaucrats gave him a reassuring statistics. At a press availability on Wednesday, Bush rattled them off. This is the day that the governor is desperately trying to get him on the phone. He's holding a press conference saying, there's 400 trucks transporting 5.4 million meals, 13.4 million liters of water, along with 3.4 million pounds of ice. Yet, Newsweek notes, yet it was obvious to anyone watching TV that New Orleans had turned into a third world hellhole. So here we are now Friday, a full 5 days after the hurricanes hit. And Newsweek says the denial and the frustration finally collided aboard Air Force One on Friday. As the president's plane sat on the tarmac at New Orleans Airport, a confrontation occurred that was described by one participant as, quote, as blunt as you can get without the Secret Service getting involved. In other words, somebody almost punched out the president of the United States. Governor Blanco was there, along with various congressmen and senators, and Mayor Nagin. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Melissa in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Melissa, listening on KPTK.
Melissa. Hello?
Hey, Melissa, you are live and on the air.
I am.
You are.
Oh, I wasn't expecting that, but I've got a few things. I think I just started listening to Air America about a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're the one that was talking about corporations getting into bed with politicians, and that's where a lot of our problems come from. And years ago in college, I was researching paper and ran across, I believe it was an 1885 Supreme Court decision.
1886, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad.
Right, the one that said corporations are entitled to be treated as persons, but they're not required to act like them.
Yep. Well, they can't. They don't live and breathe.
Well, they're made up of people who live and breathe.
That's right. And all of those people have rights.
Yeah.
So what's your point, Melissa?
Well, I just wanted to know if you were aware of that one. And also,
yes, I am. In fact, I wrote a book about it called Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights.
Well, I wish I could afford books.
Well, the library has it for free in Seattle.
Good. That's right. Okay. Anyhow, the other thing is, I was wondering if anybody's been reading the Declaration of Independence much, because Thomas Jefferson puts a real good description of what kind of government we have a right and a duty to overthrow.
Yeah, he absolutely does. And Melissa, thank you very much for pointing that out. And in fact, we've been sharing pieces of the Declaration for some time here now. Robert in Ohio on the line. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, how you doing there?
Great.
Hey, I heard either you or Ed Choate mentioned last week sometime that 9 contract workers had been killed by the Louisiana police. Could you elaborate on that or let me know whether that's a credible story?
Yeah, you did not hear that from me. To the best of my knowledge, that's not a credible story. But I can't say authoritatively, so I'm sorry, Robert, I don't know.
That's not a problem.
Yeah, I'll try to check it out. I'll try to find out and get back with you. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning.
Have you heard the latest, if there is the latest, on the Tom DeLay investigation? Anything new?
Well, his PAC was just indicted. His Political Action Committee, the Trim PAC, the Republicans for a majority in Texas, or Texas Republicans for whatever it is. You know, it's the Trim PAC. And by rejiggering the House Ethics Committee and putting Doc Hastings, his crony from Washington State, the guy who, you know, he now has a situation here where all of the Republicans on the House Ethics Committee are beholden to him. Either they've given him money or he's given them money. In terms of whether or not he's going to be prosecuted, as far as I know, I think it's Ronnie Earle. Is he the name of the prosecutor down there in Texas?
Yeah.
As far as I know, Ronnie Earle has not brought out any indictments specifically against Tom DeLay. But, you know, a lot of people are holding their breath and waiting to see what's going to happen. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Peter in Sarasota Springs, New York. Hey, Peter, what's on your mind today? Peter? Okay, we'll move along to Tony in Washington, D.C. Hey, Tony.
How you doing?
Great.
Great. Good show as usual. This may be a little controversial, so you can answer or not answer, but is it true that the mercenaries, the Black Hawk mercenaries, are now doing work down there in New Orleans in the Gulf Coast states?
Yeah, Blackwater is the name of the company.
Right.
And they're the notorious mercenaries. The 4 of them were killed in Fallujah, for example, which then, you know, our revenge for that leveled a city of 300,000 people. Yes. As far as I can tell from several different news reports, Blackwater and other mercenary groups are down in New Orleans. At first, my assumption was that this was just rich folks hiring private security firms to protect their homes, which is an old story, but it's been going on in America for forever. But one of the reports that I read this morning indicated that these guys are actually carrying badges and claiming
right.
that they've been deputized by the governor. And that story, as far as I can tell right now, is still unfolding. I can't say that I know the details of it at this
point. And number two, this is a comparison. Is it true that in the Gaza Strip that we're paying families who are leaving the Gaza Strip in Israel? I'm talking about the state of Israel. The politicians over there who think this is an anti-Semitic question, it is not. I'm just trying to find information.
Right.
That we're paying them $300,000 to $400,000 to move per family, and we're only giving them $2,000.
Yeah, there's sort of a truth and a half truth there, Tony. It is costing a couple $100,000 per family to relocate the settlers in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli government is paying for that. And we supply the Israeli government with billions of dollars of aid every year. And so you could say indirectly that we're paying for that. But no, we're not writing a check to the families from the United States.
So we're still looking for the 40 acres and a mule.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I know.
Take care.
Thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Tom in Charlotte Springs, Virginia. Hey, Tom.
Charlottesville, Virginia.
I'm sorry, Charlottesville.
Thank you very much for taking the call.
Hey, Tom, can you hang on just right after the break, okay? I'm sorry. The brand new day on a brand new clock. We're going out at different times than we used to. It caught me by surprise. It is 45 minutes past the hour. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So long, honey dear, where I'm bound, I can't tell.
And welcome back, my friends.
Goodbye's too good a word, babe. So I just say fairly well.
Oh, my. I could listen to Bob Dylan all day. I mean, we're not going to, but I could listen to Bob Dylan all day long. Okay, let's go back to Tom in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Tom.
Hey.
What's up?
Well, one of the many ironies of the hurricane response is the way FEMA was discredited and dismantled. For so long, FEMA was one of the major whipping boys for the ultra-right wing because theoretically FEMA would be the one to administer martial law and take away their guns.
Yeah, well, not just theoretically. I mean, FEMA, if you're going to deal with a disaster, you have to have extraordinary authority, extraordinary powers. And those powers, and I think rightly so, to, at some level, have spooked a lot of people, particularly, as you say, on the right, the far right, as it were, but some on the left as well. And it's a tough one. I mean, consider if you ran the government or if you ran FEMA or whatever, and you've got to have the ability to be able to deal with a disaster, and yet in the midst of that disaster, you've got, for example, looters and people shooting at you. You've got to have a level of authority that supersedes the normal. And yet at the same time, you know, you don't want to blow a hole in the side of the U.S. Constitution. It's a tough one.
Well, the Bush administration served that special interest in dismantling and discrediting FEMA.
Yeah, see, now that's where I disagree with you. I don't think that the Bush administration took apart FEMA because the right wing was flipped out about FEMA's power, because the right wing also thinks it's a marvelous thing that Bush is keeping Jose Padilla in prison and you know, an American citizen. I mean, this is probably one of the most important court cases of the last 50 years, just happened last week, where the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the president could ignore the Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendments to the Constitution and just take any American and throw them in jail and never give them access to a lawyer, never give them access to a court, never give them a hearing, never charge them with a crime, just throw them away simply with a stroke of the pen. And it's wrong, and it's criminal, it's illegal, it's absolutely wrong. And the judge who wrote the opinion is one of the people on the short list that George Bush is considering for his Supreme Court nomination. I mean, this thing stinks to high heaven. So, you know, I don't, so my point is, I don't think that Bush dismantled FEMA as a tip of the hat to the right wing folk, the extreme right who are worried about FEMA's power. I think it was simply that Bush doesn't believe in government. This is the whole thing. You know, the Bush-Reagan philosophy, this is the death of representative democracy. Reaganism and Bushism, their fundamental founding belief is that government is bad, that all things government does is bad, and therefore at every opportunity they've been taking apart government organizations, whether it's the EPA, whether it's the organization that's protecting our food, USDA, whether it's the FDA, whether it's OSHA, whether it's the Department of Labor, you know, no matter what it is, if they can take it apart, they'll do it, and if they can't take it apart, they'll stock it with cronies who will suck it dry. And that's what happened at FEMA, That's my take on it. Tom, thanks for the call, though, and thanks for sharing your opinion with us. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Chris in New Hampshire on the line. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi. Just a quick question regarding the publicity and such. I was wondering if the government was going to allow a publication of a timeline of the support that was requested from the government and the support that was received and when, and also the support that FEMA had blocked.
Yeah, such timelines are out there, and we've been talking about them on this program, and you know, other folks talk about them on their programs, and it will come out. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me. I saw a fairly truncated one, but one that pointed out that Governor Blanco had asked for federalization even before the hurricane hit in my local newspaper, The Oregonian, here in Portland, Oregon, over the weekend. So the word is getting out, Chris. Whether or not the government will do it, I mean, I don't think it's their job to do that. Certainly not in a way that's going to make them look bad. They're not going to do that. It's just, you know, that's the political, unfortunate political reality. Larry in Young Harris, Georgia. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom. You know, the thing that concerns me the most is how apathetical that the Democrats, I mean, the powerful ones, have been sitting back watching this, because none of this should surprise anyone about this whole administration from day one.
These guys should be rip-roaring, screaming.
You're damn right. Where's Kennedy? Where's Kerry? I mean, where are these people?
Well,
they're scared for some damn reason. But what?
Well, no, hang on just a second, Larry. Let me just tell you this. You know, for example, Nancy Pelosi comes out. And she says, and this is Nancy Pelosi, okay?
He chose someone with absolutely no credentials. And you know what? When I said to the president that he should fire Michael Brown, he said, why would I do that?
Right.
I said, because of all that went wrong, with all that didn't go right last week. And he said, what didn't go right? Oblivious, in denial, dangerous.
She's speaking of George W. Bush when she says that.
I saw that.
It got very little circulation. The fact of the matter is, Howard Dean is, the Democrats are speaking out. It's simply not being reported.
Howard Dean, you know, needs to step, all of them, but, you know, they've got to stand, they've got to keep this thing alive, and because what's going on is so damn true, and this was going on the first, I mean, the whole thing about Bush and what you were reporting earlier about the article in Newsweek and all that stuff was known, has been known for a while. I guarantee that everybody acts like it's, oh, all of a sudden, because he's in his last 4 years, we can start talking about him a little bit.
Yeah.
People were scared to death to talk to him, because it wasn't the right thing. Look, the Democrats.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Larry. To my affiliates. Sorry, we just dumped a little bit there. I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you that the Democrats have to stand up and say enough already, and you know we're not going to take this anymore, and speak the truth. Just very simple, very straightforward. But the bottom line here is that these guys don't believe in government. That's what people have to understand. And so it's perfectly natural that they would be trying to take apart government that they don't believe in. I mean, it's just absolutely perfectly natural. And it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that they would be taking apart a government that they don't believe in, that they wouldn't care about it, that they would run it badly all the time that they're making their salary and Dick Cheney is accumulating his stock options and all this other stuff. You know, it just shouldn't surprise us at all. And that's the true tragedy. The true tragedy here is one of perspective, of a failure to believe in the United States of America on the part of the Republican Party, George W. Bush in particular, and the Republicans and the cons who are following him, as well as many of the conservative Democrats out there. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
They're incredible! They're edible! Natural and so pure!
The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 6.5 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room. Fred Smith is with us. Fred is the president and founder of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, their website. Fred, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you today.
Glad to have you. I understand, you know, the Competitive Enterprise Institute is all over the place. You guys are, you know, I see you on national media constantly, and I know that you've had a big influence on the Republican Party and even in many ways on the Democratic Party.
You may be giving us a little more credit there. It's awful hard to be responsible for politicians of either party, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I don't think either one of us would want to take that one on, would we?
I don't think so, no.
There you go. Okay. But
We try.
Yeah, and I think that your efforts are bearing some fruit. Particularly, as I said, with the Republican Party. Although I see even who's the commentator on CNN, the old guy with the bald head, who's he's a fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, is he not? The guy who does the political commentary in the afternoons. Bill, I'm drawing a blank.
You're thinking Bill Schneider? No,
Bill Schneider.
Close. That's a problem with Washington nomenclature. He's with the American Enterprise Institute, a considerably larger organization.
Oh, I see. Okay, so we have competing conservative think tanks here.
Well, I'd like to say complimentary, but yes, so
okay.
Different ones. Yeah.
All right. Now,
lots of different furrows in the field of public policy.
Right. Now, Judy Kent, with your organization, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, has written a piece that essentially suggests that the free market is going to solve all the problems of Louisiana. Can you explain that to me?
Well, I would say that Louisiana has tried the populace. Indeed, the 1927 flood, which a beautiful book if you've read it, The Rising Tide, which discusses sent Louisiana down the populist strike. It led to Huey Long and then eventually Earl Long and the Long family getting elected.
Well, it also led to the rise of Herbert Hoover.
Exactly, the rise of Herbert Hoover,
the
Court of Engineers, it created both on the Republican and the Democratic side a sort of tendency to let government do everything. Government, sort of the best and the brightest, was going to run the lives of you and I.
Just a second. You don't really mean run the lives of you and I. You mean the best and the brightest were going to take care of us if we had a disaster. Let's not demagogue here, Fred.
Well, no, but in fact, I think it was much more than that. They were going to control floods. They were going to handle welfare. They were going to be the safety net. They were going to do all the things that they no longer thought a free people voluntarily could do for themselves. The Red Cross was fine and good in an earlier society, but now it was going to be national disaster relief. Local governments could have handled some of the problems associated with flooding and others, but now the government was going to do that. And we've seen the fruition of that, almost 80 years, 90 years later, and it's pretty disastrous. It turns out that encouraging people to look to the highest level of government or the state level of government, anyone but themselves, has created more poverty than we'd like to see, much less self-reliance than we'd like to see, and the disaster that's FEMA, Washington, New Orleans, has not been a glorious response system.
Okay, so you're bringing up really two issues here. The first is you're suggesting that the failure of FEMA is because FEMA is a government agency, not a private agency.
Well, but it's a centralized agency. Yeah, that's right. Number one.
And number two, you're suggesting that one of the problems with all those poor people down there in Louisiana is that they're poor because of the welfare state, the Rush Limbaugh line. Let's separate those.
Well, not just that. It's more than that. I mean, Louisiana is also been a state because it's been so politicized. I mean, I was born in Mobile, but I was raised in Louisiana from 8 years all the way through college. Pearl River, Slidell, New Orleans, all places totally devastated by this event. And throughout that period, I don't know if you've ever been to Louisiana, but
I have. Several times, many times. I've not been there during Mardi Gras, but I've been to New Orleans many times.
It's a great, it's got a lot of wonderful things about it, but it is a state that for years had this cute little story that, you know, a state that doesn't tolerate corruption, we insist upon it.
Well, you know,
funny, but not so funny now because people pay the price of that. Government.
Okay, so let's get back to the original point here. You're suggesting that it sounds to me like what you're trying to do is put out the talking point that the reason that the federal government, that FEMA failed in New Orleans was somehow because of corruption in Louisiana. But I would suggest to you that FEMA was working just fine with Hurricane Charley in Florida. In fact, you know, they did a marvelous job there. They were distributing within 24 hours of the hurricane and the deaths of many people. They were distributing food baskets with fruit, turkey, and ham in them. They did a marvelous job after Hurricane Francis in Florida. It's just that, you know, they dropped the ball here. And I would suggest that the reason they dropped the ball isn't because, gee, we shouldn't trust in big government agencies. It's because George W. Bush and his policies of following your line of not believing in government, not trusting government, have eviscerated an agency that once was a noble organization that has saved many, many lives and turned it into a dumping ground for political cronies.
You've got to be telling a joke here. FEMA, a great, brilliant organization. Come on. FEMA is, what did Broussard say in Jefferson Parish? It may be federal. It may be dealing with emergencies. It may be an agency. But it sure is not a management organization.
Exactly, under George W. Bush. Absolutely. I'm telling you, I'm agreeing with you. During the last 4.5 years, George W. Bush has taken an agency that's done a lot of good in this world and in the United States, and by stacking it where you've got the top three people at FEMA are all political cronies of George W. Bush's, with no experience whatsoever in disaster management, what do you expect but they'd screw up a disaster?
Well, the progressive era always believed that we could have politics without politicians, and it would be a nice theory. It hasn't worked out that way. Politicians staff political organizations, and we get what we expect. Incidentally,
no, I'm sorry. That's called cronyism, and it should be illegal.
Well, cronyism is not unique to Democrat, Republicans, or indeed libertarians, as a matter of fact.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with that, but it should be illegal. What George W. Bush has done is something that if not illegal, at least everybody should be looking at. I mean, you and I, instead of sitting here saying, oh, it's all the fault of those poor people in Louisiana or the corruption in Louisiana, we should be looking at George W. Bush and saying, this guy ruined a federal agency.
ideas have consequences, and bad ideas have consequences, too. And the creation of a society that thought corruption was kind of cute has been disastrous. Because remember, FEMA mismanaged everything, but FEMA mismanaged less. The effects of that mismanagement were much less in Mississippi, which in
so,
many ways...
So what do we do with all the corruption that George Bush has brought into this, into his administration?
Well, Louisiana precedes George Bush by a good bit. Look, George Bush has
FEMA.
George Bush has plenty to answer in this case. Blanco has plenty to answer. Nagin looks like he did a little bit better, but Nagin has stuff to answer. And indeed, a society that has allowed 34 an area that has allowed 34% of its people to be abysmally poor, much higher than most parts of America, has to ask itself, why has it destroyed its own future? Because Mississippi,
could that have something to do, do you
better.
Think, Fred Smith?
Huh?
Now we can shift to the poverty discussion if you want, because you know, you're suggesting that you've got all these poor people there and it's the result of the Great Society programs. And yet the Great Society programs over the last 20 years have been dramatically rolled back. Reagan started deconstructing them. Bill Clinton ended welfare as we know it. This is a bipartisan thing. We saw the first 4 years after Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty, we saw poverty in the United States drop in half. Over the next 20 years, you saw an entire generation of largely African Americans who had never lived in anything except poverty become a substantial chunk of the middle class. The black middle class is very substantial now in the United States because they had an opportunity over the course of a generation to step out of poverty. Those supports have been pulled out from under them in the last 20 years because of philosophies like yours, and then you guys sit around and say, oh, look at those poor people.
You really think that, like, Louisiana is a state that we really should get serious about because it is a disaster. It's an embarrassment to the United States. It's part of our, it's a third world country inside a midst of a country that is doing pretty well.
Fred, would you deny that from 1965 to 1985, there was a substantial increase in the black middle, a more substantial increase in the black middle class in Louisiana than ever before in American history or ever since?
I guess we agree. We both agree that the effort.
It was the result of the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson.
The effort to turn to turn poverty into a political issue, the view that it was not that there was no individual self effort had no value, and that therefore
I'm not suggesting that
people out of that.
I'm not suggesting
that.
I'm saying if you want people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, give them bootstraps.
And Louisiana is a classic example of why the "throw me something, Mr." mentality has done nothing to really help the poor. It's helped wealthy people. It's been great for cronyism. Talk about cronyism.
Oh, I know. Tax cuts for billionaires is the "throw me something" mentality, but nobody is saying that we should simply throw money at people. Even the most wild-eyed liberal is not out there saying, "Oh, let's just let people live on welfare for generation after generation."
You must not have been reading the same newspapers I've been reading, because unless I'm mistaken, and I have friends who are very affluent who are now taking advantage of this, we just gave everybody who applied early enough a $2,000 debit card. Wouldn't you love to have had a $2,000 debit card because you had a bad year last year? That was, how do you defend that throwing money at problems?
You call having your home wiped out and being on the edge of starving to death having a bad year?
There was no attempt at all to differentiate between the people whose homes were perfectly fine and the people who lost everything.
Except that they're all living in the Astrodome in Texas. Okay. Fred Smith, it's been a good conversation. You give as good as you get. I appreciate it. Thanks for coming on our program.
No
Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Good talking with you, Fred.
Good show. Take care.
Thanks. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Let's get it started. Ha! Let's get it started in here. Let's get it started.
Yes. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 and a half minutes past the hour, our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com. They have the latest iPods and all things computer, all things Macintosh, all things of interest. It's fascinating to hear the conservative talking points. They're out there already. The right-wing think tanks are out there already saying, oh, it's all the fault of the poor people. It's all the fault of poverty. It's all the fault of corruption in Louisiana. It don't look at that George W. Bush guy. Don't, you know, do not. No, don't pay any attention to him. You're just, you're not supposed to, you know, be looking over there. That's just, you know, pay no attention.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Yes, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. Oh, my. The free market will solve all our problems. Didn't you know that? Now, you know, there's a lot of good things about the free market. I don't want the government making my shoes or my car or my computer. Thank you very much. I'm a big believer in the free market. I've started 7 companies in my life. I'm all in favor of free enterprise. But there are times when we get together collectively and we say, you know, there's some things that are bigger than we can do in this small local community or even in a state. And so why don't we collectively get together as a nation and take care of those things? And when you have people who don't believe in governing, they can't govern. It's just that simple. It's very straightforward. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. John in Boston, Massachusetts on the line. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
The last time I spoke with you was just after the 2004 election.
Mm-hmm.
And I said at that time, we as Americans now, more than ever, have to take to the streets, just like our brothers and sisters did in Kiev.
Mm-hmm.
We have got to take back this government because we're at a point now, people don't realize this, we're on the verge of losing this government. We're talking about things like the Patriot Act, McCarran Act, Americans held without trial, 1,900 killed in Iraq, religious right. Don't you think those things have ratcheted up since the 2000?
I do. And I'm very concerned about the 2006 elections. The Democratic Party, if they have any, and I talked with Howard Dean about this 4 or 5 months ago, if they have any sense at all, the Democratic Party will be right away talking to John Zogby about putting together, about saying, okay, John, here's $5 million, go do it. Putting together national or whatever, $50 million, I don't care what it costs, putting together national exit polls. And because the Ukraine did not happen by accident.
No,
there's,
it did not.
There's a group of 5 guys out of Serbia who put this thing together. They did it first in Serbia. We observed it and said, hey, that works really cool. And we funded them. Our State Department funded them, plus
yes,
the Democratic and Republican parties funded them to do the same thing in Soviet Georgia, to do the same thing in Belarus, and to do the same thing in the Ukraine. And they were successful in 2 out of those 3 countries, as well as in Serbia. And what they did is they came up with a logo. The logo in the Ukraine was Time's Up, or the slogan was Time's Up. The logo was a ticking clock, and it was simple enough that you could cut it out on a piece of paper, use it as a stencil with a can of spray paint, and put it on sidewalks all over the city. They put together exit polls, and we helped fund those exit polls that were overseen by credible organizations like the Organization for European Cooperation, in Europe,
right,
whatever it's called.
Right.
And then, because the government owned the media, which is not that different from here, where the government is in bed with the big corporations who own the media, because the government owned the media, they got the word out before the government could release the election results. And they got the word out by using the internet, by using blogs, by printing pamphlets and passing them out, and by literally running down the street and
right,
yelling, hey, guess what? And, you know, the exit polls show that so-and-so won. You know, the good guy, Yushchenko, won.
Well,
and
Tom, you know,
we've got to do that this time.
The thing is that
particularly with these voting machines rigged the way they are.
Yeah, what we're seeing, when we see these tens of thousands of people in Louisiana marching, you know, for food and, you know, shelter and that sort of thing, that's going to be a normal, everyday occurrence in this country if it continues on this trend.
I know.
John, I'm talking about union busting. I'm talking about
these things. I'm right there with you, John, and we have to get active. We have to get politically active to take back the American political culture. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen. Thank you, John, for that call. Ellen from Washington, D.C., what's happening there?
Well, as you know, I have both Greg and Victoria at the hearings, and it's interesting the way they're approaching it. The Democrats, Kennedy, Leahy, and Biden are talking about rights. In fact, Kennedy gave a marvelous speech talking about gender, age, gay, and disabled.
Where John Roberts is going to say this is none of the federal government's business.
Well, that's right. And Biden ends with a paragraph. He said, Judge, if I only looked at what you've said and written in the past, I'd feel compelled to vote no. You dismissed the Constitution's protection of privacy as a so-called right. You derided agencies like Security and Exchange Commissions that combat corporate misconduct as constitutional anomalies, and you dismissed gender discrimination as merely, and I quote, a perceived problem. And it's interesting, the Republicans, Hatch and well, Spector said he hadn't decided how to vote. But Hatch went into this long thing about not having to answer questions, and then he invoked Ginsburg saying, well, she refused 60 times to answer questions, and she said no hints, no forecasts, no previews. And so that is how this is it boiling up.
That's absolutely incredible. Ellen, can you hold the line for just a second? I need to talk to you off air for just a second. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Thanks for the report today, Ellen, from Washington.
You're welcome.
Much appreciated. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Viagra for your brain.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends.
Wave the flag.
This is Country Joe.
Those who won't be coming back. Numbers rising, build another wall.
Yes, indeed, my friends. Country Joe, formerly of Country Joe and the Fish, the infamous song or famous song, What If They Gave a War and No One Came? His new song, Support the Troops. It is possible to support the troops and say the best way to support the troops is to get them out of Iraq. In fact, not only is it possible, in my opinion, it is the only way to truly support the troops, is to say, enough already. It's just absolutely wrong what the Bush administration has been doing. All of this entire war for political capital. George W. Bush back in 1999 telling his biographer that if he became president, if he had a chance to invade Iraq, he would do it, and he wouldn't do it in the screwed up way that his father did, with a short little war that doesn't arc over an election cycle. He would do it right. And he would get political capital that he could then use to get his programs pushed through. Keep in mind that one of the very first things he, when he ran for his failed run for Congress back in the late 1970s, he was saying that we had to privatize Social Security. That was his main stumping point. And, of course, he lost the election. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
It's ironic that they knocked the prevailing wage rate down in Louisiana because that was designed to keep up the economy of the area where you're having these government tax-paid product. But isn't it odd that this man can't lower the gasoline prices by executive order or get the gouging of Halliburton of the GI's mills in Iraq or the gasoline sales that Halliburton is claiming they're paying by gods and the government more for that. And
what's even more amazing is that when he tries to get Congress to pass a law giving churches money, the Congress says, no, we're not going to do that. James Madison vetoed, his first veto back in 1812 was a bill giving money to the churches to care for the poor. We're not going to do that. There's this thing about separation of church and state. So by executive order, George Bush creates his Office of Faith-Based Services and gives $1 billion to churches in the year before the election. And all of a sudden, all these churches are out there going, hey, vote for George. Surprise, surprise.
Right, Tom, what I was thinking about, you know, and this is one possible way to do it. Why couldn't everybody that has a job stay home for at least one day or 2 days to send a true message to this guy to wake him up? Because, really, I think the man hiding behind this is Cheney and his, you know, cohort, and they're pushing every possible way that they can get the working class people down on their knees begging these people.
Oh, yeah. Well, this has been their plan, Jim, right from the very beginning. It's Ronald Reagan's plan. I mean, the whole thing is dismantle the middle class. And I realize this sounds, you know, Machiavellian to the point of bizarre, but follow along for a minute. If you have a strong middle class, you have a politically active populace. A politically active populace is not a good thing if your agenda is to destroy government, because politically active people basically like government. by and large. I mean, you know, everybody loves to hate the Department of Motor Vehicles, but the reality is that nobody wants, you know, drunks on the road. Nobody wants unlicensed people on the road. Nobody wants unsafe vehicles on the road. Nobody wants their car slammed into by the guy whose brakes went out. We want the Department of Motor Vehicles to actually be there making sure that our cars do work properly and that licensed drivers are the ones who are driving. And, you know, it's nice to make fun of the bureaucrats, but the reality is that the vast majority of what government does, we, the people, like and agree with. And then you've got this idiosyncratic, ideological fringe that used to be called the radical right, that was even to the right of Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater was just terrified of the communists. And, you know, you got Ronald Reagan and now George W. Bush and all these right-wing think tanks and Grover Norquist and the whole bunch of them, and they really believe that government is a bad idea. They don't believe in the social contract. They don't believe that we together can do things. And the reason why is because when you take government out of the equation in dealing with the commons, the water supply, the food, you know, the safety of our food, the oversight of our pharmaceuticals, the national highway system, whether or not our air is pure, whether or not our water. When you take government out of the administration of the commons, an enormous vacuum appears, a vacuum into which people can step and they can make billions. Billions. We spend, for example, let's just take the example of healthcare. We spend in the United States almost twice as much as the next most expensive country in the world, which I believe is the UK. I may be wrong on that, but I believe it's the UK. We spend almost twice as much per person on healthcare, and yet we still have 45 million people with very limited access to healthcare because they have no health insurance. Why is it that we're spending so much? Is it because we have the best healthcare in the world? No, I'm sorry, we don't. We may have the most MRI machines in the world, but we don't have the best healthcare by any measure of it. We don't have the best infant mortality. We don't have the longest lifespan. We don't have the smallest, you know, percentage of our population who have infectious diseases. We don't have the smallest percentage of our population who have non-contagious diseases, chronic diseases. However you measure it, we are on the edge of being a third world country with regard to the health of this nation. And yet we spend almost twice as much as anybody else does on healthcare. Why? Because we have a privatized healthcare system. And every other industrialized, every other developed country in the world has a public healthcare system. So the cons come along and they say, hey, look at Bill Frist's family proves it. Bill Frist's family made their billions, and his father is one of the richest men in America. He's worth multiple billions of dollars. Frist himself worth hundreds of millions of dollars. That they made their money buying up formerly private or public hospitals, county hospitals and things, when Reagan started, you know, changing the rules so that you didn't have to have a local community hospital be non-profit. It could be for-profit. So he started buying up these community hospitals and running them and squeezing the blood out of them, so cutting the wages of the people working there, changing the nurse-to-patient ratio so that there's more patients per nurse, and creating efficiencies of scale. And so the cons say, you know, look, we can provide health care cheaper than Medicare. Medicare, you know, the cost of administration for health care, about of every $100 spent on health care in the United States, about between $2 and $3, between 2 and 3%, between 2 and 3 out of every $100 spent on health care through Medicare sticks to the fingers of the bureaucracy. That's what it costs to administer Medicare, to pay the salaries of the people who are writing the checks and doing the paperwork. And the private health insurance companies, they say, we can do it for less than that. We can do it for, you know, 2.1%, 1.9%. And they're right. They're not hiring people, you know, who are union scale, and they're not hiring people who have pensions, and they're not, you know, they have a lower cost of labor, which, by the way, drives down the standard of living for all Americans. They do have a lower cost of labor. However, even though they're doing it somewhat more efficiently than government, that is to say, much less expensively than government, for every $100 that passes through the hands of the private insurance companies and the HMOs in the United States, somewhere between $15 and $30 sticks to their fingers. But their actual cost of doing it is only, you know, $1 to $2. Why $15 to $30 sticking to their fingers? Well, because you got to pay the CEO. millions of dollars. You got to pay the senior executives millions of dollars. You've got the gold-plated faucets in the bathroom of the private jet. You got the corporate headquarters. You got the marketing campaigns. And let's not forget, most important of all, you've got to pay dividends to your stockholders every quarter. You've got to make sure that you have profits that you can distribute to those who own the company. And plus, you've got marketing and advertising campaigns. Plus, you've got salespeople out there knocking on doors because you're competing with other companies. You add all those things together, and a privatized healthcare system is going to cost you, when all is said and done, you know, far more than twice as much as a public healthcare system. In the United States, you know, the cost of administration or the total costs, we're looking at, in some cases, as much as 10 times as much. There are some things that it makes sense to have government do. Just simply makes sense. But these guys don't believe it. And that's why you're seeing these Blackwater mercenaries now in New Orleans. You got these guys who are down there making $350 a day. Why? Well, because the philosophy of the Bush administration, the Bushies, is, hey, why give money to government employees who have a fairly strong union that doesn't like Republicans? Why give money to government employees when you can give money to a private corporation that we can invest in and get that government money back? So now heavily armed paramilitary mercenaries from the Blackwater private security firm, infamous for their work in Iraq, are openly patrolling the streets of New Orleans. Writes Jeremy Scahill and Daniela Crespo in CommonDreams.org. They're carrying local ID. They're carrying badges. In fact, if you go to Blackwater.com, they're bragging about it on their website. This is crazy. Why is it that we're paying Halliburton in Iraq to serve food to our troops, and we're having to pay their people $100,000, $150,000 a year to be over there, plus Halliburton gets to skim off the top, plus they get an automatic profit on top of that, when we could have GIs do it? Remember the old days, GI, you know, potato duty, potato, no, not anymore. Halliburton's taking care of all that. And that might have something to do with why this war is now the second most expensive war that we've ever fought in the history of the United States. It's got nothing to do with how hard it was or how long it was. It has to do with the fact that it's being mostly done by private contractors. This privatization mentality, the Bush administration and folks like the American Enterprise Institute, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and on it goes. This privatization mentality of them is what is destroying this country. It is simply a technique for theft of your tax dollars and mine, stealing from us and giving to themselves. It's not healthy for democracy. It's not healthy for the United States. And it's something that's got to change. It's got to stop. It's the Tom Hartman Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Have you ever got a note from your bank saying,
"Greetings, your account just shrank by 25 or 30 bucks. Sorry, friend, you're out of luck. You bounced a check. That's what it was. It happens to the best of us. Please cover it quick."
And when you do, you find you got another one or two.
Yes, indeed, because it just makes so much money for the banks to do it that way. You got to know. I mean, see, this is the same thing. We had a woman call into this program. She was the mother of a young man who had died in Iraq, a soldier. And he died on the road to the Baghdad airport. What was he doing on the road to the Baghdad airport? He was going from downtown Baghdad out to the airport to get his mail to see if his parents had sent him a letter. Why was he doing that? Because Halliburton had been given the contract for delivering the mail. And they had decided that week that the road was too dangerous, and so they just weren't going to deliver the mail. And this kid died. Privatization. Ain't it wonderful? Well, Halliburton's making a lot of money. It certainly is wonderful for Dick Cheney's stock options. But for the rest of us, for we the people, I think not. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Gary in Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks again. I wanted to finish my thought. It sure is. I believe what you're saying here is what I totally, totally agree with. A major theme we must keep going, keep focused, that they are the philosophy of against government, that government is government's evil, and that's what we have to keep.
In their mind. And the reality, Gary, is that government can be evil, and we've seen that. We've seen that in fascist Nazi Germany. We've seen that in fascist Italy. We've seen that in the Soviet Union. Government can be evil. Government can do terrible things. Our government has done terrible things at times in its past. And, you know, the genocide of Native Americans, the condoning of slavery, we have done terrible things. And government in a constitutionally limited, representative democratic republic, government in our kind of government, very simple and very straightforward, is about we the people. And we have to, if we want to have a moral government, we have to take it back and take control of it. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, what's up?
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking the call. I would like to pay tribute to the banquet of greed and the orgy of corporate corruption in America and the fascism that is permeating this country now. Ever since Ronald Reagan, when he... He didn't just say no to drugs, but he never said no to corruption. There is no longer, Tom, a middle class. The only unions anymore are government unions.
Well, it's not true, actually. The government unions represent about 2.5% of the unionized workforce, or 2.5% of the total unionized workforce, and about 8.5 to 9% of the total unionized workforce is non-governmental, Will.
How many millions of are there in government unions?
I don't know.
25 million, at least. That's in just the federal government.
That's not possible, Will. Not possible. No, it's not possible, because there's only 100 million people in the entire U.S. workforce, and only 11% of them are unionized. That's 11 million people total in all unions. And 2.5%, 3% of that is government. So it's got to be, I think you've missed a decimal point there, because it's got to be 2.5%, something like that. Thanks for the call, though. I appreciate it. It is time for... Let's take a call, actually, from Allison in Humboldt County. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Morning, Tom.
Good morning.
How do you think this happened? It appears that very greedy people planned how they were going to take over. But where are all the good folks that still care about all of us?
Well, I think we're still here, Alice. I mean, you after 91 years, you're still here. I'm still here.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but have you in all your years seen anything as corrupt as this administration?
No. It's just, it seems like every time you turn around, there's something you find out that, it just makes you sick.
Yeah, I don't disagree. Alice, thank you for calling and sharing.
Okay.
I appreciate it. It's always great to hear from you.
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
Yes, Tom DeLay's Political Death Watch. U.S. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, this is from the Houston Chronicle. He's visited Reliant Park, and it has offered him a glimpse of what it's like to be living in a shelter. While on the tour with top administration officials from Washington, D.C., including U.S. Secretary of Labor Elaine Chao and U.S. Secretary of the Treasury John W. Snow, John DeLay stopped to chat with three young boys resting on cots. The congressman likened their stay to being at camp and said, "Now tell me the truth, boys. Isn't this kind of fun?" They nodded yes, but looked perplexed. Tom DeLay is another example. Newt Gingrich started this thing. He came in, and his language was so nice. Of course, you know, Frank Luntz helped him put together his contract on America. And if you go through, and I actually did this a year or so ago, you go through Newt Gingrich's contract on America, and you discover that 6 out of the 10 points, when you actually follow the links back, you know, they sounded very good. Government will become more responsible, blah, blah, blah. When you go back to what he was actually legislatively proposing, it was tax cuts for the wealthy. 6 out of the 10 points. You know, the term limits wasn't tax cuts for the wealthy. But balanced budget wasn't tax cuts for the wealthy. But 6 out of the 10 points, tax cuts for rich Americans. And just this whole idea that the wealthy of America will be our salvation. I agree with Thomas Jefferson. He said, "I don't look to the rich for the salvation of this country. I believe in the people." I believe in the people. And I believe that we can rise up again and take this country back if we get politically active. And the way to do it is to get involved in the political process. We just have 13, 14 months now till an election. Shorter than that before the primaries. Now's the time to contact your local Democratic Party, your local Republican Party, your local Green Party, whatever it may be, and say, I'm here, I want to sign up. Yes, Republicans, I'm telling you, if you're inclined, if you're a decent person, I would love to see the Republican Party taken back by decent Americans. It's been hijacked. It's been hijacked by pirates. Let's take back our political parties. Let's have a decent election in 2006. We can do it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The newest talking point. This is incredible. You'll recall that in 2002, Hurricane Andrew hit Florida. Produced a lot of flack. And it took 5 days, apparently, for National Guard troops to get there. Actually, I'm going to have to fact check that. Anyhow, here's the new talking point. This is the new talking point. The federal government pretty much met its standard timelines, but the volume of support provided during the 72 to 96-hour time zone was unprecedented. The federal response here was faster than Hugo, faster than Andrew, faster than Aniki, faster than Francine, and faster than Jeannie. There, I'm telling you, I've got this bet with Heidi. I'm going to win it. Within 30 days, more than half of Americans are going to be convinced that George W. Bush handled this whole thing right, and that all the problems are the fault of corrupt Democrats in Louisiana. And they always append the word corrupt before the word Democrat. I'm telling you, Frank Luntz has focus grouped this thing to death. They've got this thing figured out. They're going with it. They've got their memes. They've got their storylines. They're out there beating the bushes with them. Those of us who have some sense of dedication to the truth are doing everything we can to try and keep things straight here. But they are going to spin this thing just as they took John Kerry, who had been a hero, a war hero in Vietnam, decorated, wounded three times, and turned him into, in the minds of many Americans, some sort of, you know, deserter, weird something, who knows, when it was George Bush who deserted. Yeah, more than 30 days AWOL, you're a deserter. During time of war. If they can turn that thing around, they're going to turn this thing around. You just mark my words. There's an election coming. They will do it. Sheila Kaplan is with us. Sheila is an investigative editor for Mother Jones Magazine. And hey, Sheila, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks.
Great to have you here. It's motherjones.org?
.com.
.com. Okay, great. And you have written a great article, Trust Buster. Tell us about the trusts that are being busted here.
Well, everybody wishes they could make money in the stock market, but by the time most of us hear about a company that's going to get approval for a new drug or one that's going to lose a big government contract, it's too late to buy or sell and make any money. But there's a group of people who get inside information every day, way before the rest of us, and they're called congressmen.
And, like Tom DeLay.
Oh, yeah.
Now, and they are using this inside information to make investment decisions?
They are indeed. For example, Judy Biggert, a Republican from Illinois, has her husband has got between $500,000 and $1.4 million worth of stock in insurance companies. And not only is she on the committee that regulates them, but she actually had the nerve to declare September Life Insurance Awareness Month to encourage people to buy life insurance.
You're kidding. She, that's incredible. What district, what part of Illinois does she represent?
Let's see. You know, I don't know exactly, yeah. But I'm glad it's not my part.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we have WINI in Illinois.
It's outside of, not far from Chicago.
Oh, okay, so it's up in the northern part of the state. Doesn't Congress have ethics rules?
Well, it's an interesting question. They do have ethics rules, but the ethics rules let members of Congress use their own judgment to determine whether or not they have a conflict of interest. There's a rule that says they're not supposed to use their office for personal gain, but nobody checks. So what happened is a member of Congress, a senator or, you know, a representative they have a form they have to fill out once a year, and they say how much they bought in a certain stock or how much they sold in a certain stock, and then they file it away and nobody reads it.
So, I mean, here we had Martha Stewart going to prison for what started out as an investigation into insider trading. Ultimately, she was not convicted of that, but nonetheless, that's where it began. And yet I hear you telling me that members of Congress, I see from your article, Lloyd Doggett of Texas, a Democrat, has heavy oil and gas industry investments. Representative Clay Shaw, Republican from Florida, has heavy pharmaceutical investments, and Doggett votes in a way that would help the oil industry. Shaw votes in a way that would help the pharmaceutical industry. Am I getting that right, or did
actually
it looks like Doggett did the right thing?
Yeah, I use those examples of two people who actually both voted against their economic interests.
Oh, I see.
But
okay.
But in other cases, for instance, with ANWR, remember when Congress voted to open up the Arctic for oil exploration?
Mm-hmm.
That many of the people who were voting to open up, you know, and allow oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge had big investments in oil companies.
Yeah, and then defense, for example, you know, let's have a war, and David Dreyer of California and David Camp of Michigan, Republicans, Senator Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada, the head of the Senate minority, he's Senate minority leader, the head of the Senate's in the of the Democrats in the Senate, and Representative John Dingell of Michigan, that they all own heavily stock in defense companies.
Right. And then and another case that I found very interesting is Senator Judd Gregg from New Hampshire. And he bought stock in Mantech, which builds information systems for, battlefield, battles. And he bought stock in this company, Mantech, and now about a year and a half later, it's up 30%, and he sold stock in IPIX, which does battlefield imaging, right before it went down from $12.64 a share to $3.28.
Because presumably he knew that a government contract was moving from one to the other?
Well, you know, I can't say what he knew, but he did decline comment when I asked him to explain it.
So how is it that Martha Stewart can be investigated and possibly charged with a felony for doing this, and yet Congressman Dreyer or Judy Biggert, Congresswoman Biggert, can do it with impunity? I mean, why hasn't somebody charged these folks with a crime?
Well, the difference between Martha Stewart and the members of Congress is that Martha doesn't get to write the laws, and Congress exempted itself from prosecution, basically.
You're kidding.
Nope.
You mean the laws against inside trading say unless you're a member of Congress?
Well, not quite, but what they do say is that each member of Congress is responsible for deciding, you know, what constitutes personal gain. The reason that they left this loophole is so that people could come in to Congress and regulate, serve on a committee where Congress does most of the work, serve on a committee that regulates something they know about, so that, an instance, a farmer wouldn't have to sell his farm if he wanted to be on the agriculture committee.
Yeah, but the flip side of that, I mean, you have so many people who have made a great hoopla about putting their stocks in blind trusts.
Mm-hmm.
Al Gore, for example, as
That's
I recall,
right. That's right.
Put his stock into a blind trust. Why is that? And in fact, many of your cabinet members, I think, are required by law to put their stocks in blind trusts, aren't
That's
they?
Right. Sure, and people at a lot of the government agencies, the top people at the FDA or NIH, they can't start flipping medical industry stocks.
But it's only members of Congress, members of the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Yep.
That's mind-boggling.
I think so.
I will have to bring this up with Congressman Bernie Sanders when he's on the program on Friday and ask him about it.
You should do that.
That's absolutely incredible. So is there any kind of a movement to do anything about this, Sheila Kaplan?
Not that I know of. About 4 or 5 years ago, there were a few members of Congress who tried to take it on, and they got nowhere, and they're no longer there.
So
I don't expect anything to happen.
You mean so the rest of the members of Congress got even with them? The presumably the congressional committees that pass out money within the parties didn't give them the money to help them get elected and things?
I think something like that did happen.
Boy, this is I thought the Bush administration itself was run like a crime family. It's starting to look like it's a little more pervasive than that.
It sure does.
We need some serious house cleaning. And this really raises the issue of the need for clean election laws. Looking at what Maine and Arizona have done with public funding of elections, just such straightforward stuff. Sheila Kaplan, your article is at MotherJones.com. It's called Trust Buster by Sheila Kaplan, an investigative editor for Mother Jones. Sheila, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it is great work that you're doing. It's absolutely marvelous. This is incredible. Congress doesn't follow the same ethics rules the House and Senate do. Judy Biggert, her husband, owns $1 million worth of life insurance company assets, and she's introducing legislation designating September National Life Insurance Awareness Month. Incredible. It is one more indication of the importance of you and I waking up and participating in the political process, raising these issues with politicians right across the board, regardless of party. We've got some serious problems here. It's 17 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We ain't asking you to love us. You may place yourself high above us. Mr. President, pity on the working man.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Telling the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about. On the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. We had a fellow call into the program, I believe it was Thursday, might have been Friday of last week, and went on at some length about how when Social Security was first started, the program was voluntary, that participants only had to pay 1% of the first $1,400 of their annual incomes into the program, blah-de-blah-de-blah. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry, you're wrong. And he's like, no, I'm right. I got the proof right here. And I said, well, you know, I think you're wrong. I'm pretty sure I know that Social Security was never voluntary. It wouldn't work if it was voluntary. You can't have a national insurance program. No, it's not a retirement program. It's an insurance program. Fully a third of the people that are covered by Social Security are not retired people. They are survivors of retired persons, or there are even people who are not of retirement age who are completely disabled. I have a good friend who's my age, which is not retirement age, who broke his neck some years ago, about 5-6 years ago, running across a bridge in the winter, slipped, fell right over the edge of the bridge and bang into the river, broke his neck. He's paralyzed from the neck down. He's living on Social Security. I mean, that's part of what it's there for. It is an insurance policy against debilitating poverty. So anyhow, this happened on the air, and several people were kind enough to forward to me an email which is circulating in the right-wing blogosphere, which says, and I quote, Franklin Roosevelt introduced the Social Security FICA program. He promised that, one, participation in the program would be completely voluntary. Turns out that's a lie. In other words, this email that is going around, and if that caller is listening now, hey, wake up. That email that's going around, it's a lie. Number two, that the participants would only have to pay 1% of the first $1,400. Sorry, wrong. Number three, that the money the participants elected to put into the program would be deductible from their income for tax purposes each year. Number four, that the money paid the participants put in would be put into an independent trust fund rather than general operating fund. Five, that annuity payments to the retirees would never be taxed as income. Okay, here's the reality. Persons working in employment covered by Social Security are subject to FICA, period. Always. It's never been voluntary from the very first day. Now, in the early years of the program, there were a lot of types of jobs that were not covered by FICA. Most of them were government jobs. That's changed over time. I mean, if you chose to have a job that wasn't covered by Social Security, but then you didn't get Social Security benefits. Now there's only a very small handful of exemptions to this rule, and that's basically employees of some state and local governments under certain conditions. Myth number two, it was 1% of the first 1,400. Sorry, at the original 1935 law, 1% on the employer, 1% on the employee on the first 3,000. And it was a regular schedule of four steps that raised this up to 3% on the first 3,000 by 1949. Figure was never 1,400. Somebody just made that up. Myth number three. Roosevelt promised that the money put into the program would be deductible. There was never any provision of the law making Social Security taxes deductible. In fact, the 1935 law expressly forbid this idea, Section 803, Title 8. Myth four, Roosevelt said this money was going to go into a trust fund. Broadly, it's correct. It was supposed to be accounted for separate from the general fund. The Social Security Trust Fund created in 1939 as part of the amendments enacted that year. It's never been put into the general fund of the government, though. Never has been. People say, well, you know, they're spending money out of the Social Security Trust Fund as if it was part of the general fund. They're not. They're borrowing money from the Social Security Trust Fund and spending it. This, by the way, is something that really began big time, borrowing money from the Social Security Trust Fund under Ronald Reagan. When Ronald Reagan, in 1982, when Reagan came into power in 81, January of 81, he was inaugurated. By 1982, he had bought into this Laffer curve thing, this voodoo economics, this trickle-on economics, where if you give big tax breaks to the rich, he thought, the top marginal tax rate when Reagan came into power was 70%. The golden age of the American middle class, from the 1940s to the 1980s, the top marginal rate was 90% until Kennedy came along. He lowered it to 70%, but he closed so many loopholes, it was effectively a tax increase. And he said that he was increasing the taxes on people in his own tax bracket by closing loopholes and reducing the marginal rate from 90 to 70%. So the people actually paid the 70%. So Reagan comes along and says, let's chop this down to 30%. He does so, expecting there to be an economic boom. After all, there was an increase when Kennedy dropped it from 90 to 70%. Nobody bothered to tell Reagan that Kennedy closed so many loopholes that rich people were actually paying more in taxes after Kennedy's tax cut. So anyhow, Reagan expects his revenue to go up. It doesn't go up. Surprise, surprise. So he looks around and says, what can I do? Alan Greenspan says to him, start borrowing from Social Security. And that way we don't have to count it as part of the deficit, as part of the budget, because it's off budget. It's government borrowing from government. So Ronald Reagan starts running up this huge debt, the first $1 trillion debt in the history of the United States. He ran up, Ronald Reagan all by himself ran up a greater debt than every president before him combined, including the debt we ran up for the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War I, and World War II. And it still wasn't enough to keep the government from going bankrupt. And so he started borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund. And every president since him has continued to do that. Bill Clinton almost got us out of that hole. And George W. is continuing. So keep your eyes open, my friends.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's no easy walk to freedom. No easy walk to freedom. Keep on walking and you shall be free. That's how we're gonna make history.
Yeah, it's not simple, but we can do it. We can do it. We can bring back freedom to the United States of America. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Our chat room, if you want to drop into the live chat room, go to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, it'll get you there. And just click the chat room button up at the top of the page, and it'll drop you into the chat room. Jeff in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Junior, the bubble boy, you know, what they've done with his administration is, you know, like you were your earlier guest from whatever the Enterprise Institute was.
Yes.
They've created a self-fulfilling prophecy. They've destroyed the government and then said the government doesn't work. It's like me poisoning a mountain stream and then saying, see?
Yeah, that's the point I was trying to make to him was, you know, Bush destroys FEMA and then says, hey, look it, government programs don't work. Yeah, surprise, surprise. You're right.
Yeah, so they've created a self-fulfilling prophecy and basically an argument where it's a circular argument. They can always win.
Yeah.
And unless we can grab hold and, you know, not let them take reign and say, hey, what about before Bush?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's wrong. It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for us. It's not a good thing for democracy. The problem is that this has been going on so long. I mean, Ronald Reagan really started this. It continued slowly under Bush the Elder, who actually, I think, had some respect for government and governance, but still had to pander to his right-wing base and his corporate base. And then Bill Clinton came along with the DLC Democrats and did, you know, a lot of good things with regard to the environment and public health and things like that, but started dismantling programs that were designed to lift people out of poverty and started dismantling the programs that were designed to protect our domestic industries and then kicked the door wide open with NAFTA and GATT. So the whole DLC Democrat agenda has been out there damaging the United States. And then you get George W. in, who's like the most radical of all of them. He's like the Trotsky-Lenin rolled into one of the Reich. And it's just, you know, it's the whole thing is going down the tubes and far too fast, frankly, in my mind. Jeff, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. I don't mean to sound totally cynical, like the whole country's going down. That's not my point. But these guys are doing everything they can to, as Grover Norquist said, he said, we don't want to destroy government. We just want to shrink it down to the size where we can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub. In April of 2001 or 2002, he told that to Mara Liasson on National Public Radio and reiterated it again with me on my local program. Just last week, I had Grover Norquist on. And they're still saying the same thing. And why do they want to destroy government or why do they want to shrink government? Because then they can step in and make more money and have more power and not be accountable to we the people. David in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, David, welcome
to
the program.
Tom, what an honor to talk to you. Thank you for being in Seattle during the week. You guys are a blessing.
Yeah, I'm pleased to be here. Absolutely pleased to be here.
It's incredible. Wow. Anyways, I'm very disturbed about the treatment of the journalists in New Orleans and the censoring of the images, especially since everything was getting out of control in the convention center. And you know, and notice that the images, you know, like the, remember that are a lot of the dome scenes that they're showing is of the Astrodome.
Right.
You rarely see any images of the chaos inside the convention center or the Superdome.
Well, it's all sort of old news now. I mean, it's the reason that you're not seeing the images of that right at this moment.
Right.
Also, I don't think that there was a lot of reporting being done from the convention center when it was hot, you know,
when
it was live. In fact, that was the outrageous thing was when I think it was Paula Zahn was interviewing Michael Brown, the head of FEMA, you know, the former guy whose major career move was busting somebody who did liposuction on the butt of an Arabian horse. I kid you not, that was the high point of his career as head of the horse owners, the Arabian Horse Association. He busted a guy for liposuction on a horse's butt. In any case, as this guy was on live TV, CNN all day long had been reporting live from the convention center, showing the scene, and she says to him, you know, what are you going to do about the convention center? He says, there's nobody at the convention center. She says, wait a minute, are you trying to tell me that you don't know that there's people at the convention? And he says, Paula, the federal government didn't know. And it's like, you know, yeah, but nobody
They're
turned
liars.
On the TV.
They are liars. Don't they watch TV?
One would hope, but David, thank you for the call. I appreciate your outrage and your sentiment, and I'm right there with you. But you know, these guys, they don't believe in reality. I mean, you got to get it. You know, a member of the Bush administration last year came out with a point that you know, we create our own reality. You know, the old days, they just did things based on reality. We create our own reality. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Hey, Roy, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I wanted to just throw out a question. I kind of emailed you this morning with the Talking Points bunch, that article that will now show up everywhere about how well this hurricane was responded to.
Right.
There are so many lies in that article.
Yeah, it's incredible. Go ahead.
And the point is, though, what is, in your opinion, the best strategy for defeating outright lies? Just like the Social Security memo that you just read, just like...
We just have to keep telling the truth, Roy.
So much of this stuff.
We have to keep telling the truth. And the main thing is to do... what, you know, Lee Atwater's whole thing was you play the refs. You know, he suggested that if you can influence the media, if you can make the media afraid to take you on or willing to repeat your lines because you've hassled them to death, then you can win the argument. And the fact of the matter is that before David Brock came along with Media Matters, which is just an absolutely sterling organization.
Everybody ought to read that site every day.
I agree. MediaMatters.org.
They know what the lies are.
Yeah, yeah. Until David Brock came along with Media Matters and John Podesta started the Center for American Progress, until these things came along, really nobody was holding the media accountable. So we need to be, number one, holding the media accountable, number two, telling the truth. And you know, there is still this huge right-wing talk machine out there, but, you know, our voices are starting to get out, and they're starting to get out in more and more places, and as they get out, hopefully we can wake people up. Roy, thanks a lot for the call.
Quick one.
Sure. Yeah.
Go ahead. Discuss the word bork and borked. We're having a heck of a conversation in the chat room about bork and borked. I want to avoid it because, to me, the cons have nailed that as a negative. That, gee, you guys are just wanting to bork people. So,
right, and as Coach Glenn points out in the chat room, he's quoting Ted Kennedy, quote, Robert Bork's America is a land in which women would be forced into back alley abortions, blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters, rogue police could break down citizens' doors in midnight raids, and children could not be taught about evolution. End of quote from Ted Kennedy. And it's true. And you're absolutely right that is the America that Robert Bork wanted, and that's why he didn't get put on the Supreme Court, and it was a good thing that he got borked now that they've created this word.
But turning it into
word.
A verb about borked.
I know. Well, you're not going to be able to uncreate the verb, Roy, but but we can keep setting the record straight, as Ted Kennedy is doing so very, very well. Brian in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Tom. It's good to have you live in Seattle.
Thank you. It's great to be on KPTK.
It's good news. Hey, I tell you what about this privatizing everything, whether it's health services or any kind of service. The main thing it does, it kind of takes away the public oversight of things when it comes to civil rights of people.
Yep.
And I think that's my main issue, because I've had those experiences where I've had jobs that were for corporations, and boy, did I feel that closing in on the dome there, you know?
Yeah.
If you've never had that experience, and people wonder, why is Brian freaking out, you know? Well, it's a social process, you know, and I'm kind of an independent thinker, you know, so I always choose my own path, and it's very important to have the media always out there, just putting some truth out there, just so we can keep that little candle in the brain alive.
Good on you, Brian. Yep, good on you. I well said, and
yeah.
And thank you very much for sharing that with us. Armin in Bradenton, Florida, on the line. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Through all the melee of this hurricane, and have you heard Bush once mention on the media that the solution to the reconstruction of New Orleans is privatization?
No, but that's where they're going. They're going there as fast as they can. And I'm telling you, the Bush buddies, the Bush cronies, they are seeing $52 billion so far.
Wait a minute.
It's a honeypot. It's, oh, boy, look at all that money.
Tom, no. That's public money. No.
You're so good, Armin, when you get facetious on me.
No.
So
what I meant was, have you heard him go in front of the media cameras and look them right in the eyes and say, you know, we're not going to reconstruct New Orleans with any socialization of the taxpayers' money. No.
Oh, I get what you're saying.
I believe so much in privatization that we're just going to wait, and we're going to do this with either charity or absolute private, totally, without taxpayers' help. Reconstruction funds.
Yeah, see, Armin, that's the line that they would talk, but the walk that they walk is taking taxpayer dollars and giving them to their buddies as fast as they can. They've been doing it in Iraq all along, and Louise says they'll privatize faster than you can get a press pass if you're a gay hooker in the White House. In any case. Thank you, Armin, for your comment. Spot on. No, you're not going to hear Bush saying that. It ain't going to happen. Rosemary in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Rosemary, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's nice to hear you in real time.
Thank you.
The reason why I'm calling is because I think we should get some eighth graders to go talk and school the Fourth Circuit Court justices, because they seem to have forgotten what every eighth grader in this country knows, which is that you cannot hold Americans indefinitely without a trial and without charging them with something.
Actually,
King George,
Actually, if I may interrupt you, the Constitution, the way the Constitution reads, you cannot hold anybody without trial and without charges. The Constitution doesn't just limit it to Americans.
And the reason why they did that is because King George, not Bush, right-wingers, don't get excited, King George would do that with American colonists. He would hold them, what he thought were enemy combatants, indefinitely without a trial. Because if you knew... And they hung them.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Well said, Rosemary, and I appreciate that. And here's an interesting historical anecdote. King George, the one that we rebelled against, was the third George to rule England. Now let's see. George Washington, George Bush Sr. Number three, George W. Could it be reincarnation?
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I wouldn't screw up the environment or the money for retirement like the liberals complain. I'd impress all my poo-pooers, shocking all the evildoers if I only had a brain.
George, what a challenge.
Now, I'd pronunciate much better, honor liberties to the letter for the folks that we detain. And when the world called me a baddie, I wouldn't run off to my daddy if I only had a brain.
Yes. Welcome back, my friends. 51 minutes past the hour, or 9 minutes before the top of the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Dave in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. We learn so much listening to your program that we don't get elsewhere. Sometimes it's hard to keep it all intact. One, and now the memory is becoming a bit vague, but I understood it might have been David Kopp of the Greens that had filed a suit in the federal courts in Ohio to literally nullify the election because of vote rigging. And last I had heard on it, Conyers had addressed a letter to Kerry because Kerry was going to disassociate himself.
Right, asking Kerry not to withdraw from that lawsuit.
And I've heard nothing more.
Neither have I. I don't know the status of it. I'm sorry, Dave.
Do you maintain contact with David Kopp at all?
Yeah, David Kopp is a good friend. I haven't talked to him in a while, but it's a good reminder. In fact, David Poole, who helps produce our program, is listening at this moment, and he just made a note. We will track down David Kopp, and we'll find out what's up with that. So,
I understood that suit was going to take its time, but it was going to come up, and if it went through, the judge could literally throw out the whole election.
We'll find out. Dave, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Linda in Washington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Linda. Linda.
Hi. I really enjoy your show, and I agree with the fellow said. I learn a lot.
Well, thank you.
That I hear nowhere. And one of the things I hear nowhere, but I heard you early on talk about the Department of Homeland Security's website, and where it said in the event of a terrorist attack or natural disaster, they have the primary responsibility.
Yeah, it's not just on their website. It's written into the law.
It's a law.
Yes.
So you don't hear any place on the media when they go into whose fault it is. I've never heard this quoted. It seems like, regardless of who asked for what, there's the responsibility.
Yeah, they're in charge. And the reality is that, you know, as the hurricane was hitting, the day before the hurricane hit, actually, Kathleen Blanco, the governor of Louisiana, asked George W. Bush to declare a national emergency. She declared a state of emergency in her state. He did the next day, Sunday, as the hurricane was hitting. And then it was like Thursday by the time he got around to figuring it out. And as Newsweek talks about this week, and if you want to find the story, you can read the whole story online right now. Just go to BuzzFlash.com, and they've got a direct link to the story. It's on the MSNBC site. Here's the headline. Bush didn't know the hurricane damage was bad until Thursday after it struck. Oh, I'm sorry. That's not the headline. That's the commentary that was sent along with it to me. I don't have the exact headline, but the quote from it, I mean, the article starts out by talking about how Bush's aides were so terrified of his anger, of his short temper, that they were literally having conference calls to discuss who gets stuck with the job of telling him that he's going to have to cut his vacation short by 2 days. I mean,
if we had a terrorist attack, would somebody worry about bothering his vacation?
Well, you know, it may well be what happened on 9/11. I mean, maybe that's why he sat there for those 7 minutes. He was thinking, how dare he come and interrupt me here? I'm sitting in this classroom. We're supposed to be reading My Pet Goat.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, talking about the media also, at first I thought, well, this coverage, they're there and they're asking some questions. I thought Anderson Cooper did a great job.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting about Anderson Cooper? You know, he's a member of the Vanderbilt family. He's this is a family of like 100 millionaires, billionaires, an incredibly wealthy young man who probably in his whole entire life never saw anything like that. And then all of a sudden he finds himself in the middle of it and he's looking around going, oh, my God.
Well, I thought, well, since they're right there, they're not going to let the media get away with what they saw and who responded and so on.
Yeah.
But I think you're right with your bet, because already this morning and watching, well, CNN, that O'Brien that took over on that morning show,
mm-hmm.
asking the question and saying, well, to the governor, exactly did you ask for the troops?
Yeah.
You know, well, when you declare a disaster and say, give me all you have, what does that mean?
Yeah, right. Right.
Exactly, what does that mean?
Right. Linda, it's absolutely outrageous. And I appreciate your calling, and thank you for sharing your perspective with spot on. Ray in Bend, Oregon on the line. Hey, Ray.
Tom, I just want to say, along with a bunch of your other callers, I think you have the most brilliant radio show on the air these days.
Well, thank you.
And I absolutely...
That's high praise, because there's a lot of good radio being done right now.
Nothing quite comparable to your show. At any rate, having buttered you up there, I'm going to come back and say...
Now, slap me upside the head, Ray.
I will, right now.
Okay, good.
All right, now, you're telling me that...
Well, we've got 50 seconds to go.
Okay, you're saying the GOP wants to shrink government.
No, I'm saying they say they want to. The reality is that they expand government faster than the Democrats do.
What they want to do is shrink the social safety net.
That's right.
While the defense budget, what they call defense, has risen from $300 billion in the year 2000 to $500 billion this year with the supplemental.
That's not including everything else.
Right. Yeah, everything else on top, it brings it up to about $750 billion or so.
Right.
And
so your point?
What we have in the Defense Department is what is called, by an analyst there, a self-licking ice cream cone. And unless America gets control of that situation, I think we're going to be forever marching off to wars that aren't going to do any of us any good.
Yeah, I don't disagree, although I don't think that having a military capacity means that you're going to fight a war. And, you know, but Roy, you make a really good point. I think it's an important point. You know, about where are our priorities for spending. But, I think we have to acknowledge we need a strong national defense. But what sends us off to war was not the fact that we had the capability to do it, but that we had a president, George W. Bush, who thought that the way for the Republicans to take the Senate back in 2002 and for him to get himself reelected in 2004 was to have a war going on during that period of time, because no president in history at time of war has ever failed to get reelected. And he knew it, and he said it, and he did it. And that's what it was all about, political capital. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for being with us today.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.